Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today, we're talking with David B. Wong about ethical relativism. There's a long-standing philosophical debate as to whether ethical claims are the same type of statements as other kinds of claims. Whether or not, for example, thou shalt not kill is the same kind of thing as 2 plus 2 equals 4. Some philosophers argue that they are the same, that they both report a fundamental truth. But their opponents argue that thou shalt not kill is really just, I don't like killing, or I believe killing is wrong in fancied-up language. On the surface, this may seem dry, but in fact, it is an incredibly important controversy with massive consequences for our day-to-day life. When the president appoints a new Supreme Court justice, for example, Congress grills the candidate on his or her position on this very topic. There, they call it natural law, the idea that rights are written into nature in just the same way math is. If the candidate believes in natural law, he or she thinks that the rights don't come from the Constitution, but from God or nature or logic. These rights, then, should never ever be taken away, even if we change the Constitution. Maybe there's a right to work, or a right to freedom of worship. But the point is, any time the U.S. does something against these rights, it's wrong to do so, no matter what. On the other hand, someone who thinks ethical claims are different from other truths may end up claiming that everyone gets to decide what is right for themselves. They may say that ethics is nothing but wanting to live in a certain way, that moral preferences are no different than musical preferences. We disapprove of torture, they'll say, the same way we disapprove of Coldplay. We call both abominations, but that's really just our opinion stated in a more forceful way. So if the government makes a law allowing torture, that's just fine, as long as we declare it to be. Now, these are the most extreme positions in the debate, of course. I'm not being fair to those who would hold a more moderate point of view. Nevertheless, most of us end up holding some version of these extremes when we encounter moralities that are different than our own. Arab-Islamic culture in the Middle East tends to think of women very differently than many American and European cultures do. Is their position moral? And if so, do we have a responsibility to get them to change their beliefs? Your answer will depend on whether you think your morality is absolutely right or not. Many Asian cultures have a strong position on the importance of family approval, stronger than, say, many American millennials. Are these Asian cultures more respectful or just old-fashioned? Again, your answer depends on what you think about morality. Some cultures eat horse meat. Others make children work. Others have caste systems, while others publicly display their own sex acts. Are these just preferences, or can they be evaluated from an objective standpoint? Is there some place we can stand to arbitrate these ideas fairly and independently of culture? Can we declare one set of beliefs superior to another, or are we always unable to step outside our own education and personal experience? In other words, are ethical statements true like mathematical ones, or are they fundamentally different? The consequences of our answers are overwhelming. On today's show, we're going to step inside this debate, but we're going to look specifically at one aspect of it. We're going to ask about that moment when we encounter moral difference and consider what it might mean to be charitable to other points of view. We're going to ask whether there may be more than one truth and consider the suggestion that ethics is neither purely preference nor absolutely true. In other words, we're going to try to find a bridge between the two extremes and ask, not simply about the rules that we follow, but about the human experience of seeking them, acting on them, and defending them. Ethics is often portrayed as the process of finding a single solution to a particular dilemma, but this is as incomplete as evaluating a baseball team by only considering its pitcher. In fact, as today's guests will show, reevaluating what ethics means involves questioning our very definitions of nature and politics, of reconsidering how human psychology works and how it helps unify a culture, not to mention a long list of other debates that are often falsely regarded as settled. To put it bluntly, today we are considering moral relativism. In doing that, we are reconsidering our whole world. And now our guest. David B. Wong is the Susan Fox Beischer and George D. Beischer Professor of Philosophy at Duke University. He's the author of numerous books and articles, including Moral Relativity and, most recently, Natural Moralities. David, welcome to Why.
Thank you, Jack.
We're live this evening and would love to have your questions and comments. You can email us at askwhy@und.edu, tweet us at whyradioshow, post on facebook.com/whyradioshow, or join the conversation with our intern Sam, who is lonely in our chat room at philosophyandpubliclife.org. Also, if you have Periscope, a service that I couldn't remember, we are there at Why Radio Show. You can see the action, at least me, insofar as I am the action. So, David, let me start with just a really basic question. What's the most basic definition of relativism, and why do people find it so scary?
I would define it as the view that there is no single true morality. And that would embrace the extremes that you mentioned, that morality is just a matter of individual feelings or preferences or culture's preferences. And that the other, well, that would be the extreme of moral relativism. And I suppose in stating it that way, one can get a clue as to why people are afraid of it. They're afraid of losing their footing. Feeling that they have no firm guide to act upon, to navigate their lives. And, yeah, that's, I think that's why they would be afraid.
You know, it that makes it seem a sort of calm but disconcerting process. Aren't there people who would suggest that relativism completely undermines morality at all, that under relativism the whole ethical project disappears?
Sure. I mean, there is the phrase, everything is permitted. If that originally was said, if God doesn't exist, but it could apply equally well to some independently existing moral reality that's part of the fabric of the universe. If that doesn't exist, then perhaps everything is permitted.
And so the argument then is that once we start allowing for all possibilities, we're lost, as you say, we have no anchor, but also there's no judge, there's no standard, and then all bets are off, and there's no punishment, there's no arguing for right or wrong, there's just whatever anyone wants to do at any one time.
That would be good way of putting the fear.
So, and I know, and I will remind our listeners that we're going to argue against all these positions. But just to run counter one more line of attack, someone like Lawrence Kohlberg famously argued that relativism is a developmental stage, that it's sort of immature, and that eventually we grow out of that. Mm-hmm. Is that also, is there a dominant sense among philosophers that relativism is unsophisticated or childish or something that we just have to get our students past in order to be good philosophers?
When I was starting out, perhaps that was truer of the community of professional philosophers, that they would regard more relativism as a view to be outgrown as soon as possible. But actually, more recently, I found myself with more company. And that may be because we're getting more used to a world in which we encounter people from different cultures every day, every minute, if we're on the internet, I think relativism, some version of that, is a natural response to the variety that we encounter. But of course, the argument starts from encountering difference and how to interpret it, what to make of it, whether to say they're just wrong or whether to step back a bit and reflect on why might they believe that? What might be behind that? I think there's philosophy is, and perhaps it corresponds to its ancient religion, it's slow to change. So I think, for example, compared to literature, it's more wedded to the idea of an independent moral reality, and you know, resistant to other ways of situating it in human life that make it more responsive to human need, but also to human conditions that can change.
That's a really interesting observation, that literature in some sense has been more responsive to human lives and changes quicker, obviously in part because literature tells a story, a narrative about a particular life. It situates a person. It situates a character. It puts a discourse in the context of a story. So philosophy has traditionally looked for outside the particulars, right? They tried to look for this universal standpoint, what technically we call an Archimedean standpoint.
Right.
Is that a connection to – is that a sense that philosophy is somehow scientific and wants to be objective in the way that physicists think they're objective? Or does it separate itself from science because, of course, science – gets its evidence from particular instances? What's the relationship between ethics and science?
Oh, that is a big question.
that's what we're here for.
Certainly, there is this aspiration towards objectivity. Philosophers might, when they're in their mode of superiority, might say that philosophy was the originator of this ideal of objectivity, and then science came along with a pretty good way of trying to reach that objectivity, at least within the physical realm. Philosophers would, I guess, reserve the right to criticize the way scientists go about it. Scientists would reserve the right to say, well, we're doing just fine. Thank you very much. But that's a conversation that you know, philosophers and scientists may be having right now. Scientists sometimes now are taking the offensive and saying, we've got the answers. And yes, they do start from particulars, but always within a theoretical framework. So there's no way of getting even the scientific truth from a pure observation. You've always got to be able to interpret your observations within a theoretical framework. An interesting development in philosophy is that some of us want to make use of science, the relevant human sciences. I do, but I think that as far as I'm concerned, I want to preserve the separateness of philosophy and the separateness of science and hope that we can have useful things to say to each other.
You know, this is actually touching on one of the reasons why I was intrigued by your book when I first saw it and why I thought of having you on the show, because the title of your most recent book is Natural Moralities. Mm-hmm. And the word nature there implies a whole host of stuff, right? Philosophy has always had an issue with the word nature. Is nature wilderness? Is nature human nature? Is nature just moral propriety? So when you take a word like natural and you attach it to the word moralities, are you asserting a scientific point of view? Are you asserting, a biological point of view? Mm-hmm. What does the word natural mean in this context, mm-hmm. and what does it bring to the ethical discussion?
Yeah. I wouldn't say that I'm trying to reduce morality to an object of scientific study, but I'm trying to tell a story about why we have this thing we call morality, while being informed by the most relevant parts of the human sciences, including evolutionary biology, including psychology, and those parts of the sciences that study why we have culture. I think all of those things I mentioned are crucial to being able to understand why we have morality. There's cooperation. Evolutionary biology has highlighted the fact that much of how we evolved was through cooperating within groups of various sizes. And we may have gotten various psychological traits to help us to cooperate with each other. There's a regard for our kin, perhaps a willingness to sacrifice for our kin, certain dispositions that help us to deal with people outside the kin group, in arrangements of cooperation, reciprocal, in arrangements of reciprocal benefit, and perhaps also some capacity to be moved by the suffering of strangers. All that might have set us up to cooperate within groups. And I think we can think of morality as one kind of structure of guides, of norms, rules, and specific judgments that human beings evolved to help structure their cooperation, to help say to each other, this is the way we should work together and not that way. This is acceptable and this other way is unacceptable. So I think that's a rough sketch of one big part of my story of why morality is in that sense natural. It's part of human life, and we can understand how it came about without presuming that morality is somehow there in the fabric of things, that right and wrong are part of the structure of the universe in the way that mass and the speed of light are part of the structure of the universe. It's a human phenomenon. It's important to us because it helps us live a human life, and hopefully a good and decent human life.
There's a strong part of me that hears that description and finds it very familiar, and I'm incredibly welcoming to the idea, because some of the stuff that I do in the Scottish Enlightenment has some similar ideas. But mm-hmm. I think that many of our listeners won't know that this approach, by calling morality evolutionary and using the term natural, this runs counter to a tradition that starts really with Aristotle, that there's nature and artifact, and that human beings create stuff, and then going through the social contract, that somehow society isn't natural, right? That society is somehow different than nature, that society is the product of an agreement, but it doesn't evolve the way that Rousseau sometimes suggests, that Adam Smith suggests. And so I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question. Do you have to assume that society is as natural as forests and oceans and dams and caves in order to have a natural morality? Or can you have that division between nature as the non-human realm and artifact as the human realm?
Mm. Well, morality is not like rocks. Or trees, although I've heard tell recently that trees are in a forest are actually part of members of a community, and they inform each other as to what's going on underground. So maybe we're a lot less distinctive than we think we are. One way we might think we're distinctive is by having culture. We develop ways of doing things that we pass on to others and to succeeding generations. Indeed, that may be a big part of the story of, you know, why we were able to develop the powerful kinds of knowledge that we have and the modes of technology that allow us to manipulate so much of the Earth and its natural resources for good or ill. Culture, I think, includes morality. These are ways of cooperating, ways of guiding ourselves towards what we might think are the most worthwhile lives. So that's it's to me, that's natural in the sense that we are human beings who have not only a biological nature, but it's part of our nature to be cultural animals, to guide ourselves through these ways of doing things that our predecessors and our peers have evolved.
Is the study of morality empirical? And what I mean by that is many scientists, although certainly there are pure theoretical scientists who work in the realm of math in a different way, but is there many scientists will observe things and use the senses or use advanced equipment as substitute for the senses to experiment and get results. Is ethics the same way? Is it trial and error? Is it empirical? Is it the result of experimentation in the scientific sense, or is it theological and abstract and almost systematic constructions for political purposes? Is it an artifice that has no necessary relationship to the things we taste, touch, smell, the mistakes and the successes?
Well, I think part of what informs my theory of morality is empirical in an important sense, that part that is informed by cognitive and social psychology. I wanted to develop a theory of morality that takes into account what we might have by way of being the kind of biological creatures we are. So what I was talking about a while ago about the dispositions we might have come to have acquired as a species through evolution, our regard and concern for our kin, our willingness to deal with others in relationships of mutual exchange, this ability to be moved by the suffering of strangers, all that I think we can make sense of, and we're beginning to make sense of scientifically. But a lot of when you're talking about trying to understand moral differences, I think we get into that part of the sciences that are sometimes called interpretive sciences. And there, I think part of it involves storytelling, to go back to the theme you mentioned near the beginning. You have to tell a story about what people mean, how they're trying to knit their lives together through having certain kinds of values. And we have to tell that in a human way, that is, in a way that makes sense to us. So I mentioned the perhaps biologically based disposition to be concerned about kin and often to sacrifice for them. Well, and as you mentioned before, some moralities, I think all moralities have concern for the way that the young are raised, and that this typically takes place in small groups, very often in what we call families.
David, I apologize. I have to interrupt you we can take a break. When we come back, we're going to use this foundation and look more deeply into your theory, ask what you mean by moral ambivalence, and then figure out what exactly relativism is and why it won't destroy the world. You're listening to David B. Wong and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this. Thank you.
the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with David B. Wong about moral relativism and taking another look to see how it fits in with pluralism and with open-mindedness, among other things. And as David's been talking, I've been thinking a lot about the travel I've done in my life. And as long-term listeners know, I lived in Vienna, Austria for a couple of years in my mid-20s. And I remember it was the first time I ever left the country. I spoke two words of German, both learned from John Irving novels, Bitte and Schlagobers, which mean please and whipped cream in Vienna, but very useful terms. And I was nervous about being in this country. I didn't know the rules. I didn't know how to act. And I told myself to overcome my fear, if I could get from the airport to the institute that I was going to for a dissertation fellowship, I would be okay. If I could just make it on my own traveling, it would work out. And so I get on the plane and I take the bus to the main terminal in the city. And then I get in a taxi and the taxi takes me to the institute and I have to pay. And I have this very, very vivid image of holding out this money that I didn't understand and saying to the taxi driver, I want to give you a tip, but I don't know how much to give you. And so he was Austrian and he was a rule follower. And so he took a very small amount and he said that was good. And he sent me on my way and I felt great about it. There are some places where they can $1,000 American, but he didn't take advantage of me. And I was trying to figure out how to describe this experience of wanting to do the right thing, of not wanting to offend him, but of also asserting myself and my desire to give something that was particularly American, which is a tip. And so the phrase that I think encapsulates this well is a phrase that David uses in his book, moral ambivalence. So David, let me ask you, what does the term moral ambivalence mean, and why is it so important in this encountering of other cultures and other moralities?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so moral ambivalence is encountering others who differ with you about something important, but it's you get to ambivalence by being open enough and taking the other's point of view seriously enough to try to understand why they believe as they do. And I say in the book that you can get to the point where you can not only understand their point of view, but it begins to appeal to you. You can see why they might have taken that path, though it remains different from the one that you took. And so that gives you a puzzle. You begin to wonder if there is a single true morality. And at that point, I present my story of why we have things like morality. It's not part of the structure of the universe. It's not something given and fixed. It's something that human beings evolved partly to be able to live together productively. And it's not implausible that people develop somewhat different ways of living together, but that these ways have certain important features in common because we're all human. We have share in common these kinds of psychological dispositions I was mentioning a while ago. So ambivalence involves both recognizing oneself and the other, that we share very important features and interests and aspirations, but it also coming to realize that maybe despite what we share in common, we might have come to take different paths. And we come to take seriously that we're maybe there's not a single right path to take.
Let me continue with that story a little bit to ask you a little bit more about this idea of relativism in different cultures. So I ended up living there for a while, and I grew up in New York City. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is wonderful about New York City is you can do anything you want as long as you're not a threat to anyone else. You could stand on the corner singing a song, no one will care. You can wear the funniest hats. You're anonymous, and people might be entertained, but as long as you're not a threat, mm-hmm. no one cares. And in fact, very few people will hold any of it against you. Mm-hmm. But what you can't do, or certainly couldn't do when I was growing up, was walk safely down the street in the middle of the night with anything valuable. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was in Vienna, I was a guitar player, and I was playing in clubs, and I'd walk home at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be listening to my Walkman, no iPods back then, and I'd know that I was perfectly safe, that no one would hit me over the head and take my stuff. And so freedom in New York meant you get to do whatever you want and people leave you alone.
Yeah.
In Vienna, freedom means you have to be that kind of rule follower that I brought up with the taxi driver, but you're safe and you're secure. Is that an example of relativism? Or is it more universalist because they both involve the idea of freedom?
It involves that combination of both something that's shared and a difference, a divergence. In my book, I explored differences between moralities I call moralities centered on rights and autonomy, and those that are centered on relationship and community. When we're traveling, it may strike us that, here's a society that's maybe more focused on relationship and community. I mean, that's certainly true, I think, of many East Asian societies and the Confucian morality that I've studied that has been influential on those societies. They emphasize filial piety. A family is the model for relationships in the wider society. So you look after your own, and you look after others as you would your family in the ideal case. And that's why it might be safer to walk to walk through the streets of those kinds of societies. There is also, you might say, a kind of cost to that. The kind of interest that people take in you might be experienced as suffocating or restrictive. I think that's a reason why we have these two different kinds of moralities that we see, I think, all over the world. One thing that I conclude pretty soon is that you can't really associate one very broad type of morality with a whole society and say that's the morality of that society. That's way too simplistic. What you have are maybe trends, if you look broadly over the U.S., and of course New York, that's a very good example of a more rights and autonomy-oriented community. Certainly there are parts of the U.S. that emphasize to a greater degree relationship and community. There are parts of the U.S. where you can walk around the streets and feel pretty safe. And that's because there's still that kind of community that's knit together.
Let me give another example, because I think that A lot of our listeners will have heard of the problem of the commons. And the problem of the commons is a standard political science problem where there's public land and everyone uses the public land, and then it gets overused and destroyed because no one takes responsibility for it. Well, I was fairly persuaded by that until I spent some time in China. When I was in Beijing and I was in a park. Actually, I'm sorry. This was in either Shanghai or Beijing. I can't remember where the park was. And in the park, there were all these people. They were doing Tai Chi. They were engaged in dance lessons. There was a poster of people with pictures of their unmarried children looking to find matches for their children. And then at the end of the day, these people would clean up after themselves. They would sweep. They would take care of it. And so in the American political science model, public ownership means nobody owns it. It looked like, at least for me and from the conversations I had with other people about it, in the Chinese public model, everybody owns it and everyone takes responsibility. Yet at the same time, when I think back to that and when I think about what you were just saying about divisions in culture, I realized that almost everybody in the park was older. Everyone in the park was, I mean, I you know, it's hard to know, 60s, 70s, 80s. Right. And so I guess what I'm trying to do is articulate what you're teaching me, which is that sometimes these claims of universalism hide the differences that are right in front of us. But then when we see the differences, it takes us a long time to see that those differences aren't universal for all cultures, but there's a discourse and a debate and a tension even within groups that seem homogenous from the outside.
Right, exactly. So I've come to think of cultures as more like conversations in which there are many voices. And a particular culture might be distinguished by having certain voices be dominant. And they're the ones who must be taken seriously, even if you vehemently disagree with these voices, you know, that the backdrop is the dominance of these certain voices. But it's a feature of the culture that there are always dissenting voices, different norms and cultural practices, especially if you're talking about a huge, diverse society such as the United States, that's continually taking in people from other parts of the world. They're coming here, and we're affected by them. They're affecting us. We're affecting them. So it's a continually evolving thing. The conversation is evolving. Who becomes dominant or what they're exactly saying can change. Going back to stereotypes of relativism, there is this stereotypical version that what's right is what my culture says, or what's right is specified by the standards of my group. But when you think about it, we belong to many different groups, and we're influenced by these groups, and we, as individuals, absorb them differently. So we are deeply influenced by those around us, and those who raise us and teach us, those we work with. But that group alone, that large group alone, is diverse. And we take it in, and we come out with something that may be fairly unique. That doesn't mean that what's right for me is simply what I say, because I am deeply influenced. I inherit the moral languages of the different groups I belong to. It's complicated like that. It's not simply relativism is not simply what I think. It's not simply what the group thinks. But they are these ways of living together and working together that have been handed down and have their influence on us. It's also the fact that, getting to pluralism, I don't think that there's any there is no single true morality, but neither is it the case that all moralities are equally true.
That was a question I'm sure that our listeners were waiting for, and of course it was on the tip of my tongue. Yeah. You know, there may be many right answers. Are there wrong answers? Are there things that are just absolutely not morally acceptable? Or is there somewhere some group that is going to make a case, and relativism means we have to respect their case?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we ultimately have to listen to what's behind their views, what possible traditions have influenced their views, and we have to try to understand those traditions. But in the end, it is a matter of what we are persuaded by. I think morality is not just a way of getting people to cooperate, but it's a way that people can accept and internalize without having to be threatened or coerced into doing so. It's something that we absorb through our culture and assimilate and make our own. So it's got that kind of, dare I say, autonomous aspect to it. Morality is something that we can internalize and use it to guide ourselves, even as we are with others, and we share it with others. But that means that there are certain constraints on what we can absorb and internalize. In my book, I argue that there have to be ways of assessing what we're taught. I think it's become part of the concept of morality that if a norm, especially one that's used to subordinate one group to another, if a norm depends on falsehoods for getting people to accept it, then that's something that we use to assess it and to reject it. And I think various beliefs that have been handed down about various racial groups or women, for example, these beliefs have been used to subordinate them, give them a place that that's lower than others, and that's the critical aspect of morality. We can ask, well, is what we're told about African Americans or women, is that actually true? Slavery used to be justified in the United States by saying that African Americans were of inferior rationality, we do make some progress. We know that's false. We are now able to see that women, as Aristotle would claim, we see that what Aristotle thought was false, that they don't have this inferior capacity of self-command, self-discipline. I think those are forms of moral progress when we look and see, evaluate the forms of justification that especially have been used to subordinate one group to another. But that is consistent with the kind of pluralism that that I would advocate. There are moralities that value relationship and community, and in the past, often they have embodied kinds of subordination and hierarchies that were based on these kinds of falsehoods about people. That doesn't mean you have to get rid of communities. Doesn't mean that you have to devalue relationships. I think that would be a pretty sorry thing for human beings. And again, I think that's one thing about that we human beings share in common. We thrive within relationships. We develop as individuals through relationships. I think that's even true of the most individualistic of cultures. And to the extent that they neglect that truth about human beings, they endanger their own foundation. They endanger their own freedom by neglecting the social foundations of that.
I want to do something which is actually a little embarrassing. I want to do what the internet calls Godwinning a threat. And what that means is the Godwin's law is the first person that brings up Hitler loses. Uh-huh. And you talk very much about understanding the other position and yeah. evaluating the other position. But there are some people who say that in something like the Holocaust, to understand is in part to be culpable, to try to Daniel Goldhagen, who was a guest on the show, in his book, he tells this horrible story of an SS guard ripping off the arms of a baby when he's trying mm-hmm. to pull it out of the mother's hands. Mm-hmm. And he says there's nothing to learn from tearing a baby in half. And I'm not suggesting that Danny doesn't think that we have to study the Holocaust because he spent his whole life doing it. But there are people who suggest that just asking for the justification gives more credibility to certain positions than we should allow. We shouldn't even give people the forum. We shouldn't even let people have the moment at the table. Do you oppose that notion? Does your searches for justification and analysis run counter to that, or is that a separate conversation?
Well,
and it's not fair to bring up Hitler. I know that, yeah. But
some conversations can be pretty short.
All right,
I think that kind of racial justification is an inch deep in terms of intellectual justification, but it's very, very, very deep in terms of whatever is behind it emotionally and the factors that bring people to that very sorry state. I think the kind of understanding that's the most useful is the kind of understanding of what leads people to that point. So I think that if you're looking for intellectual justification, there's not that much to it. And we can listen. But certainly if it's a matter of saving somebody from getting torn apart, you act first. And then you do try to understand, I think, if nothing else, to try to see what led led people to that state, and to try to prevent it the next time.
So what's of interest then in, say, Holocaust studies or any genocide studies are not the arguments for the genocide, but rather the historical circumstances, the literature, the philosophies that they use to sort of examine how they got from one point to another.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so ultimately, in the last minute, is what you're suggesting that really – arguing for universalism, not giving relativism its credence, is being both profoundly disrespectful of cultures, but also having a very simplistic view of cultures, that cultures have their own moralities and that all of them are deep and sophisticated in some sense, and that we can't eradicate all that history in that culture? Is that an oversimplification?
Well, I don't want to leap to the generalization that all of them are deep and sophisticated. I think that, the conclusions we draw should depend on our investigation. I think what I would insist on is that we make the effort and that merely standing and asserting we are right without even considering why other people might believe what they do is not only unjustified simply from the point of view of knowledge seeking, but it's closing ourselves off from learning from others. We might actually take something from others, a tip or so, tip or two, about how to live together. We don't have to become them, but one terrific thing about the United States is that, compared to a lot of other societies, we have been open in that way. We've become open to be having even our American identities affected by people who come here.
So, David, I want to take a step back. We got a question from someone who didn't leave their name. Please, listeners, do that. And the question, I'm going to tell a story afterwards to adjust the question a little bit. But the question is, does a morally relative society assume respect for humanity to be innate? Does it presume cooperation? And the word cooperation really triggered another memory for me from that trip to China. This time I was in Shanghai, and I had gone with a whole bunch of people to a restaurant, and we had gone through the beautiful lit highways of Shanghai and the crazy fast traffic, and it was one of those taxi drivers. And we're having a conversation over dinner, and this woman was arguing about the paleo diet and some other things. And she just said, you know, I want to go back to a time when there was cooperation. I want to go back to a time when people cared about each other and worked on projects together. And I looked at her and I said, you want cooperation? We just drove through one of the most densely populated cities in the world at 90 miles an hour. We drove through highways and under buildings, and everyone was obeying the traffic lights, and everyone was engaged in this project of neither killing themselves nor anyone else. That's cooperation. Now, she wouldn't have any of it. So the question that I want to ask with this term cooperation, with this term respect, going back to this notion of freedom, is relativism that there are just fundamentally different values, or is there something more akin to, let's say, an overlapping consensus where every society has a virtue of cooperation, they just define it differently? Every society holds the importance of respect, and they just define it differently. Everyone has, let's say, something like marriage, although that's problematic, and they just define it differently. Or would relativism suggest that there are places where cooperation is just not on the table, or freedom or respect or marriage just isn't on the table, and we also have to engage with them as well?
I would say that within the pluralism I accept, it's more of the overlapping consensus in the following way. There are common values that we interpret differently over across different societies, and even within a single society, we tend to differ on that. We also differ on how we prioritize values, relationship versus autonomy. Some societies place more emphasis on individual freedom, and others on nurturing relationships between people. I don't think that any society could do without some degree of concern for nurturing relationships between people. I mean, that, in some sense, cooperation. Nor do I think that any society within the range of true moralities could do without respect for the individual's vital interests, and among those are interests in doing what one wants. But I think these are prioritized differently or across different societies. Where the person you had a conversation with in China was, I think, harking back to a time when there was more concern for relationship and community. It's a kind of a commonplace now in China to observe that there's been that kind of deterioration in the kind of emphasis that people place on their relationships. Not surprisingly, there is something of a movement to revive and reconsider Confucian morality. They're looking back to, as it were, the roots of traditional Chinese culture, and seeing if some modified version of that, updated version of that could perhaps form a new moral basis for Chinese society. It's very much a matter of concern given the infusion of capitalism within that society and the kind of culture that brings of increased individuality, increased self-interest, acting on self-interest. And the worry is that I think there's not that much interest in terms of the majority of Chinese people in becoming just another version of the U.S., for example.
It's interesting that you bring this up, because what I was doing in China was doing a series of five episodes of Why, several of which were in front of a live audience. And our first one was an interview with someone who was putting forth a Confucian political theory. Uh-huh. And so this is something that if our listeners want to go back to, it's about 4 years. But Why Goes to China is a five-episode
I looked at
series.
It myself.
Oh, well, that'd be wonderful. So how do we know which questions are questions of morality and which aren't? I mean, only the most bigoted person is going to criticize people who use chopsticks or who eat with their hand traditionally or something like that. So, you know, chopsticks isn't a moral what utensil you use or don't use is not a moral question. Mm-hmm. But how do we identify, especially given the different cultural priorities and the different interpretations, what constitutes a moral question?
Mm-hmm. Well, there certainly questions of harm to others, physical harm, those are our moral questions. But so are questions that affect the degree of trust and the ability of people to work with each other based on their sense that others will do as they say or have the qualities of character that make them trustworthy. Those, I think, are almost just about everywhere moral questions. But it's interesting that you bring up etiquette. One of the distinctive features of Confucian morality is that it actually does pay a lot of attention to what we might call questions of etiquette, questions of how one expresses respect in everyday interactions, how you greet one another, how you take meals with others, how you do that respectfully. I think that's actually one of the things that we could pick up from other cultures. There's, I think, a good deal to be said for paying more attention to the way we structure our everyday interactions with each other. We may affect the kinds of attitudes that we take towards others on what we call the really important dramatic moral questions. But this may be the infrastructure of those more dramatic interactions is the way that we relate to each other and behave towards each other on the everyday level, the small details. I think, one of the concerns I've had about American society is that a lot of that has eroded. It's not just a matter of walking on the street and feeling it's not safe, it's not secure. But I think it's, some of the infrastructure that used to make places safer has eroded in the sense that we're less able to make connection with each other, less able to form a community with others. When there's that kind of impersonality, it's much easier for crime and other kinds of unsafety to occur.
You have this really powerful example in the book that it was the kind of thing where I had to put the book down and think about it for a while. You're talking about Confucian ethics, and you said that a person who's acting properly under that system has to do the right things for the right reason, which is very familiar to us in lots of. But then you said, and they have to do it aesthetically with this with the right aesthetic, with a proper sense of grace. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really interesting and powerful, this notion that both aesthetics and grace can be moral categories, especially in a society now like ours, where not only manners are being devalued as from the extreme of calling it all politically correct to just the bluntness of various different places, but also the loss of the respect for arts and humanities, mm-hmm. that considering the aesthetic as a moral category is an incredibly enlarging point of view.
And it's so much more positive than simply holding people to their duty sternly, is said in a very stern tone. It's more positive to find acts of moral excellence to be elevating, uplifting, to fill one with a sense of the potential beauty in human beings and their conduct. I think we're more receptive to that idea, that more positive aspect of morality. The psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who often has interesting things to say about morality, brings up a letter from Thomas Jefferson advising his correspondent to read works of literature because he would encounter descriptions of acts that would inspire through their moral beauty. I've lately begun thinking about that in comparison with the Confucians and thinking, yeah, maybe we've lost something important here, our ability to feel graced by what other people do, to be able to celebrate it and be inspired to emulate it ourselves. We're now so often, our moral stance is prone to criticism or, peremptory direction. You must do this. You're a bad person because you haven't done that. But I think our ability to connect with each other rests more, on more finding value in what we do, what others do, and expressing our appreciation for them.
I married a Southerner, and early on in our relationship, once we started living together and having guests, and I visited her family and all that, our greatest tension was around various different definitions of politeness. That as a New Yorker, I was very direct, and she helped steer me to a different way. And at the same time, my goal is, she had the sense of hospitality, which was different than mm-hmm. mine. And my goal, coming from the Jewish tradition that I have, is just to feed people incessantly. And so now we have this household with a lot of food and a lot of welcomeness, and it's the combination of both of those things. So this, of course, goes back to your point that no culture is monolithic, right? That even in the United States, you have the North and the South, but even in a marriage, right, there's this tension between values and how do you open yourself up. But what would happen if the Northerner and the Southerner, let's put the marriage question aside, but the Northerner and the Southerner were so different that they couldn't find common ground? How do you accommodate difference? What's the expectation in a relativist society for accommodation, and what would that mean amongst moral differences?
Yeah, well, I think accommodation is necessary because even within a family, even within a neighborhood where that's a real neighborhood, people just have different views. We usually get along despite that if we want to, if we resolve to keep the relationship on a constructive level and try to manage our disagreements. And I think there are various ways that we can do that and still maintain our moral integrity. We can be honest about in expressing our views, but try to find ways of acting on them that perhaps are more gentle and less aggressive or less imposing on others. There are various ways I think we can enact trying to accommodate others while disagreeing with them. Sometimes it involves finding ways of blending, as in your marriage, food I can tell you my own story. When we first moved down here to North Carolina.
And actually, my wife is from North Carolina. She's a Tar Heel. She went to UNC. I know UNC. You're from Duke, so I'm actually going to be punished for even talking to you. But and also she's from Asheville, and we, you know, so we're from the same world in a certain sense these days.
Yeah. So it used to, when I first got here, it used to drive me a bit nuts that I'd be in a line at the supermarket, and the checkout person would be striking up a conversation with these people ahead of me, and they were taking their time, and I was like, oh, come on. But then I got up there, and then I have this nice conversation, and then I sort of started thinking, well, what's your hurry? it's good to have this human interaction.
You know, I have to tell you, because you have touched on the core example, my favorite example of what it was like to sort of enter into this southern world. I'd always said, here's the issue. You go down south, and I always say a pizza place, although there aren't really pizza places in the same sense in Asheville. But you go to a pizza place, and they want to say hello, and you have this conversation. And then after 5 minutes of pleasantries, you say, you know, let me get a slice of pizza. In New York, you go to the counter, you say, let me get a slice of pizza. And then while they're getting the slice of pizza, you have the conversation and the banter. And so the politeness and the connection are there, but they're in opposite order. So if you go and you just walk at the counter in the South and you say, let me get a slice of pizza, they think you're incredibly rude and you don't want to talk, even though you're going to talk in a couple minutes. And in New York, if you talk to them first, they're like, hurry up. I'm busy, even though there's going to be space for talking. So I totally get where you're coming from. And so
it's like learning another language.
It is.
We have to be in our society nowadays multilingual in that sense.
So is this, I mean, this is sort of a stupid question given what we're talking about, but is this relativism? Is this what relativism looks like? Not the anarchy and chaos and fire and brimstone of the philosophers who are afraid of it, but just the everyday push and pull of different people with different priorities and interpretations of norms and expectations and, of course, moral commitments. Is this what
that's a good part of what I mean by it.
Okay.
And my complaint about the way that relativism has been treated in philosophy is a caricature has been held up as a convenient whipping boy. It's as if, you know, the thing is, philosophers find it so hard to come to a consensus about anything. And I think that one response to that is, well, if we can't agree about this or that, let's find some common object of derision and scorn. But then you have to caricature that, because if you take it seriously, you have to consider more plausible versions and things that people might do with arguments that we do all the time in philosophy. We sort of consider the most plausible version of a view. I think that's what hasn't been done with relativism by and large.
And it's a microcosm of what we have a trouble doing in the world, right? We caricature the other, and we stereotype, and we treat them at their worst, not at their best. So I want to ask you one last question before we go. And it's the question that you end the book with. And I want to ask it partially because your answer is very powerful, but partially because it's actually not a question, surprisingly, I've had the chance to ask on the show in the close to 9 years that our ninth season, so 8 years plus since we've been doing it. Why should we be moral? Why, in the face of relativism, in the face of difference, in the face of goodness and badness, it might be easier, it might be more satisfying to certain desires to just abandon the rules, to abandon this accommodation, to abandon this charity for the other person's point of view. Why should we be – this is – and our listeners should know, this is – the classic Platonic question. I mean, this is a 2,500-year-old question. So I didn't invent it, and you didn't invent it. But but why be moral? What, from a relativistic point of view, is there an answer to that?
It's more complex than the Platonic answer. That it's if you see the good, if you truly apprehend the good, then you will see why be moral. You have the answer.
Right. That's Plato's answer.
Yes. I think morality can answer to very deep human needs. It can answer to the need to see something beyond the self and to invest much of yourself into that something larger than yourself. It answers to, it's a way of connecting to others. It's a way of making your mark when you pass. We're all going to go, and so the question is, what kind of mark are we leaving? And doing right by others is one good way. I think I'm not saying anything new, but pointing out what there is in us that responds to morality. But I think, again, in the positive way, that there's something beautiful there that we can respond to and that people can remember us for.
Well, that is a tremendously positive and hopeful and optimistic answer, and a wonderful way to end this conversation, especially since we started off with such suspicion about the topic. David, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Oh, thank you very much, Jack.
You've been listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We were talking with David B. Wong about relativism in ethics, what it means, how to deal with it, and how to accommodate difference when you encounter it. You know, I started off the show by talking about the fears of relativism, about the notion that, as David puts it, everything is permitted when there is no absolute rule. Anything goes. There's anarchy. There's fire and brimstone. There's people eating people, dogs living with cats, right? Just the whole vision that people give of relativism is terrifying. And then by the end of our discussion, we got to a place where relativism means a happy marriage, where relativism means having a good conversation at the supermarket or at the pizza place. So what happened in between? How did we get from the most scary vision of chaos to the most almost benign notion of what a good home life is? The answer is to recognize that there are a lot of commonalities between cultures, but they're not always on the surface, and they aren't always in the same measure. Individual respect may be the top priority in one culture when family is the other. Freedom may be a high priority in one and security is another. Aesthetic considerations and politeness and grace may be one culture's aim, while another culture wants bluntness and directness and truth. We also have to recognize that there is this thing called moral progress. Because there are multiple rights, but there are also wrongs. And that's where the caricature of relativism goes awry. This notion that when you allow for more than one truth to enter into the discussion, you allow for anything no matter what. The fact of the matter is that a pluralist notion of morality, a vision of many right answers that can talk to each other even if it's difficult, allows not only for a more stable world and a more open and accepting world, but also a more interesting world, a more beautiful world, a more challenging world. When we face difference and we close our eyes to it, we don't have anywhere to go. There's no way to grow. But when we encounter difference with open arms and open eyes, well, then we enlarge ourselves, we enlarge our intellect, and we enlarge the consideration that we give to everything in the world that we don't necessarily see at first glance. This does not mean that welcoming everybody will be easy. And it does not mean that in the end, we want to sit and have a meal with every stranger, regardless of what they think is important. But it does mean that our gut instinct, that our immediate repulsion from the things that challenge us is not just a barrier to our intellectual growth, but it's giving us a distorted view of what morality is and what values are. Relativism isn't a nightmare. Relativism is a good conversation, an opportunity for change, and a world full of difference and sometimes complexity that, while never perfect, gives us a rich and fruitful future full of new and wonderful things. You've been listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein. As always, thanks for listening. It's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.